This is an interview with Dr. John Cooper on the, oh gosh, the 14th of November 2006 at Goodwood, South Australia for the University of Adelaide Oral History Program, and the interviewer is Rob Lynn. John, you were born in Adelaide in 1928, but I wonder, would you tell us a little about your parents, please, and who they were?
Oh, my father was a member, second, third generation member of the Cooper family, I guess you can say. And we lived in Tasmore Avenue, Tasmore. It's, I had five, I was one of five members of the family, three boys, two girls. My father had a business of his own, and he'd built a small factory for making malt extract and continued doing that from, I guess it was about 1920-ish, and from then on. My mother was one of nine, by name of Kinnish, the family.
Sorry, what was the name?
Kinnish.
Oh, K-I-N-N-I-S-H.
I-S-H. I understand. My grandfather came from the Isle of Man, and it's a Manx word. Yes. And
I was going to say, that explains it.
That's right, Kinnish, Kuish, or something like that, I understand. Yeah. And where should we go from there?
And your father's Christian name was John also, is that correct?
Yes, that's right.
They sent you to school at Prince Alfred College, as the family tradition would have it, I suppose?
Well, I actually started off at a local school. It was a partly owned suburb out there at Tasmore in those days. And there was a small private school in a local church, local Presbyterian church, run by one woman who taught you by sing-song, but everything went in, you know, up to 12 times table in grade two without turning a hair.
Fantastic.
Yes, and then in third year they sent me to Prince Alfred.
Yeah. I think you told me the other day your father had an interesting way of getting you there. He took you there, but you found your own way home, is that right?
That's right, yes. I was in grade three. Haven't worked out the age, but at the beginning of grade three, and yes, he took me there in the car, and we used to roam everywhere at that stage and know your way around, but I'd never been down there and on my own, and he dropped me off and he took me in and made sure one of the teachers had me in hand and let them know who I was, but I was given instructions on how to get home, which involved walking up from Prince Alfred's up De Quetteville Terrace to the Britannia. No buses in those days. There was a tram coming up Wakefield Street, which went on through Marrottville to Burnside. And I dropped off from Tasmore Avenue and walked home. And and not surprisingly, my father was on the veranda reading the paper and watching his watch at the time. But we were expected to do things in those days. Or the boys were. The girls weren't so much. They were looked after pretty closely. But the boys were, in general, got out and did things. Yeah.
Did you have siblings yourself, John?
Yes. I had two brothers. Yeah. Who were younger. One sister older and one younger. So there were five of us all together. Yeah.
And John, what was the scientific education like at PAC at that time?
Well, in the primary school, the preparatory school, as they called it, the preppers, I dare say it wasn't much different to anywhere else. I can't really comment, but the teaching in the senior school for the upper classes was very good. They had a very good upper level. But remember, it was wartime by the time I got there. And there was a terrible shortage of teachers throughout the country, throughout the state. And Prince Alfred felt this too. The one rung of the teaching was pretty poor. And I've heard the same from other schools. It was a very difficult time. Mm. But they did have a very strong senior level in the sciences particularly, yes.
I think we mentioned the other day that R.T. Ray Smith taught you physics.
That's right, Ray T. Smith taught us physics. It's another Smith taught. Ken Smith taught us mathematics. He had been the headmaster of King's College, but he'd got cancer and his time was limited and he wanted to keep on teaching. He finished up coming to Prince's and was a great asset in the maths area, as well as a chap called Williams, Spanny Williams we called him. I can't remember his first name. It was always Spanny. But we were well done by, and also in chemistry, Ray Smith and a fellow we called Cupy Close. we did well with our science teaching. There wasn't much in the arts line there, though, you know. It was just... it went by the by, although Ward himself was a very strong on the classics, somehow it didn't get through. I guess it was a problem with finance too. These schools found it very difficult and they couldn't do everything. They didn't have any foundations behind them as they often do now.
Now tell me, John, what decided you to go to the South Australian School of Mines in 1947? What was the rationale behind that?
Yeah. Well, I guess I wasn't thinking very far. I always had this idea that I'd follow up with this mould extract business as a business, because there was a living in it, which it was difficult to get a big salary of any sort in those days, and I thought this was the broadest thing. If you're on your own, I wanted the chemistry side and the engineering side to sort of run a factory or make decisions on keeping a factory going. So there was a combine industrial chemistry, which seemed to be broadly cover the situation. So that's as far as my thoughts went, and I didn't think any further, which at that stage, which was perhaps a bit silly, but anyhow, how it went.
Now, the course of industrial chemistry you took at the School of Mines, half of that was actually at the University of Adelaide.
The chemistry subjects were done at the University of Adelaide.
Can you describe what the university looked like in those years, in that part of it?
It was very open, of course. There's only about half the number of buildings that there are now. And what it looked like, a sandstone university, it had that look, with the art gallery next door and the main School of Mines building, the Brookman building, was there, of course, and at the corner of Frome Road in North Terrace. Behind it was the newly built Bonython Engineering Laboratories, and that stood out in red brick amongst the rest of it. And not so obvious was the medical school, the old medical school on the other side of Frome Road. That just looked like part of the hospital.
Mm. So where were your main lectures for chemistry at the uni, in the Kerr Grant Theatre?
No, down on Victoria Drive, the Benham.
Mm-hmm.
Beg your pardon, not the Benham, the Johnson Laboratories. Mm-hmm. Got that wrong, I'm sorry. Actually, there was a huge overflow of students and we did our first year organic chemistry lectures in the back of the Brookman building. The place was overrun with CRTS students, people a few years older than us and highly experienced in the world. And there was a bit of a change for us to have us young fellows and then they step up to men of the world. Yes.
Did you find it a very interesting time to be there with study?
Oh, yes, it was. It was a big change from school. And I do recall that lecturers in both institutes were very much alive and aware of things. Things were starting to change. Knowledge was coming out that had been held back during the war. And there was this rivalry between the School of Mines and the university. At first and second year levels, where they both taught almost parallel subjects in engineering particularly, and each one trying to be as good as the other, and particularly the School of Mines people liked to think that they were equally the equal of the university teachers. In fact, at their first year level, in mathematics, they made it harder. They made the students do an extra lecture a week, and they lectured for several weeks longer than the university did. And they kept piling the stuff in too. And it was much harder to pass their exams than the university.
I've heard that from others too. But can you recall any of the university lecturers of that era who would have taken you for chemistry?
Well, the organic chemistry one, I do remember, Dougal Slee at the School of Mines. He was actually a school teacher, I think, originally, and he'd got this job. He was a good school teacher, and they brought him into this job, and he was very, very good. Now, first year chemistry, gee whiz, Dr. Cook in second year. Dr. Cook in first year, I beg your pardon. I attended the engineers chemistry classes. That's where we were led into for first year inorganic work. Old Dr. Cook, he was as dry as an old boot. Second year, give me a moment. Roger. Oh, he went on to Leeds. Irving, I think it was. Roger Irving. He was a young chap. And he was the first to teach the electronic configurations of the units here in Adelaide, of the elements, orbits and orbitals sort of business, and interested that when another geology staff member at my age came from Brisbane, and when I told him we'd done this work in second year, he was absolutely amazed. Lecturers again, and I was trying to think of one. Nossel was a younger brother of
Gustav.
Of Gustav. Yeah. He taught me second year organic chemistry. Yes.
I knew he was there, but
he died young. I think he had some sort of, I guess it was some sort of leukemia. He used to be always a bit pale, but within, he had driving energy. He was a good lecturer. Yeah. I can't think of his first name, but as a brother of the other Nosser.
Yes. So, John, was there also a social life around the School of Mines and the university in those years?
The School of Mines didn't have the same sort of time to spare. Most of the students were part-timers, and so they were doing the course in their spare times, and there was that sort of set up there, and I played football for the university, even though I was basically a School of Mines registered student. They accepted the School of Mines people as third year students, and they could play sport. You had to join the university union,
of course.
So
being part of the union, you would have played footy, what, on the main university oval?
Yes, with the university teams, trained with the university teams. Yes, that's right.
Was that, and that would have been amateur league, I suppose.
Amateur league, yes, indeed. And I was secretary of the Uni Football Club one year, and I think we had five teams and had to find grounds for them, had to register them all and find grounds for them to play on, and it was quite a business.
That's a lot of teams.
Yes.
A lot of people, just for footy.
Five in amateur league. Yes. Well, not many people played hockey in lacrosse. A few did in those sort of games. And most of them tended to go into football if they were going to play a winter sport. Mm. Yeah.
Mm. And, John, you said to me that you really enjoyed your time studying, if one can enjoy it.
I had it rammed into me by my dad that if you don't want to work with your hands, learn as much as you can and do it now, because you won't have a chance later on. Mm. My working hours have decreased a bit since then. As I told you before, I worked the system a bit in later years.
Now, The course at the School of Mines had a more practical orientation, didn't it?
Yes. The practical classes were quite extensive, and also they were overseen quite well. Whereas the uni, they'd give you something and to do and leave you for the day. Mm. That's in the organic classes particularly, that give you something to prepare, which might be a 5-hour job, and if something went wrong on the way and you'd check the yield of what you're supposed to get and find you got something else, the bloke looking after you would say, oh, well, you oxidised the thing in the air. And then it's your fault that the air got in, and no instruction about putting it in a sealed container or something like that. Yes. So, well, that's the way it worked in those days, and they were pushed too. But I think it would be fair to say that the School of Mines teaching staff had the attitude of school teachers, and this is one direction where I think it was good. They made sure that things ran a bit better.
Mm. Now, your first job when you came out of the School of Mines was with the South Australian Department of Chemistry, is that right?
That's right, yes.
And that was situated just off Kintore Avenue, am I right?
Yeah, on Kintore Avenue, and what is that place there now? Well, it used...
The Migration Museum.
Migration Museum, it used to be... A home for destitute women in its early days.
The destitute asylum was indeed.
Asylum did they call it? Oh, well, I think it was probably the fact that they were destitute rather than mental. But anyhow, it was a very solid place. And the cells, they had cells there. Yeah. When I was there, one of the staff members was so-called the Chief Inspector of Explosives. For the state, the government represented on the safety of explosives, and they used to keep any explosive they had on the campus, they kept in the cells that they used to lock these unfortunates up in. Yeah.
But John, you said to me the other day that was a very interesting time working with Alan Hickenbotham Senior there, and
yes,
some of the problems he set you.
he was good. I did work with one other fellow to begin with, but Hick stood out afterwards. He inspired you a bit. If you had a bit of a problem, you'd sort of come along here, what's going on here, you know. And he spoke like that, that sort of way of talking. And then he'd say, well, why don't you try this, try that. You know, he'd encourage you. He was a very friendly man who would encourage you, and he was all ready for a joke too.
Now, John... as an aside to this, it seems to me almost from your birth you were interested in geology through your father's interest. So would you like to tell us a bit about how that came about?
Well, the father's background, he got, unstable's not the word, but he got itchy feet, I guess, when he was home, and he wanted to get out and see if he could make his way in the world, and there was a mining boom on at the time, and he headed north and got a job with the mining companies. He found that it wasn't easy going, very hard work, but he worked in the Blinman mine. Copper was the thing up that way, Blinman mine up north, and the Mutna mine near Arkaroola, which is known these days as Red Sprig Country.
Oh, yes.
Yes, but when he was settled down here, when I began to understand things that were going on, but he'd still go out on weekends fossicking around the Adelaide Hills and have an offsider who perhaps might camp out at a certain place they got interested in, and he was always picking up specimens and looking at them, and he had the equipment to make on-the-spot analysis of certain elements, which was useful for what he wanted.
So did he take a little chemical laboratory with him, did he?
Well, it was just a little packet. It included a blowpipe and the sort of things that Mawson carried with him. I think it was probably what he set up, what Mawson put together, and hand lens and scratching tools, the same as the sort of thing they had in the classes at first year level. But I thought the unique thing was the blowpipe and the little candle and carbon block where you could you could melt a spot of what you had and get colours and so forth to guide you.
Did your father ever take you on those trips?
Oh, no, only the weekend ones.
Yes. Not to Blinman, no.
No, no, the local weekend ones that he went out on. Yeah, yes, he did. And I used to get a bit bored, actually. I'd very little then. Gosh, how old was I? I was about grade four or something like that. And it was a bit early for me to catch on. I learned a few names and could recognise a few specimens, but it was just a bit early for me to go any further than understand the looks of things.
Mm. When do you think that geology sort of hit you between the eyes? When would that have occurred?
Well, that was when I went to the ANU, really. But prior to that, I was in Broken Hill acting as a chemist.
Yeah.
And we saw things that came up from underground. But there were geologists up there who were quite separate. People worked in separate groups, and geologists were working very hard at that time trying to find new ore bodies. The future of Broken Hill was beginning to look a little bit bleak just then also. But they kept you very, very busy in the chemistry laboratories, and when the 5 o'clock came, you left. And we really saw the geologists. They were another part of the campus, and that's the way it worked. No, but getting back to your original question, it was when I went to Canberra, when I came across the research side of what was going on in geology, and the processes involved were emphasised, and that really struck me as being very interesting, and has ever since.
But before we come back to that in a minute,
I jumped things a bit.
No, that's fine, John. I'd love to talk about Broken Hill, because it 1955, I think it was, you went there. Would that be right?
Yeah, that'd be right.
Yeah, that analytical position you took up would have... Now, that was Broken Hill South.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
You would really have had a fair bit of work in front of you at that time.
Oh, yes. They kept you busy, very busy. I can remember one day that you'd have an off-sider to help you, but you'd weigh out your samples yourself and to perhaps finish up with a titration. That is running a liquid in and measuring how much we needed to neutralise what you had. And anyhow, one day I did 118 such analyses.
How many?
118.
In one day?
In one day. I mean, I'd weighed out 118. It was a sort of routine where you had a range of different sorts of samples, some that you had to be extremely careful with and to get accurate results. And others were just samples from the operating mill that they had to keep track of how the mill was working. We only needed approximate answers for them, so you'd weigh them out almost. Well, that's near enough, throw it into the beaker, and when you're titrating it, you zip along fast, and if you overshot a bit, it didn't matter. And so you had this routine in those in between where you had to be more careful, but it wasn't that essential. And then the concentrates were... which had monetary value, high monetary value, to be extremely careful. But it was a lot of work. I didn't do that every day. That was one day. That's the day I remembered.
That's an awful lot of analysis.
Yes, well, my previous job, you know, that would have taken a month or so.
Yeah. Was it a job where you learnt to be both quick and accurate, would that be fair?
Yes, that's right. And also sort out knowing when the sample comes along, say that's it's an underground sample, as they called it, a sample of a bit of rock that's been knocked off. Mm. The approximate answer was all that was required. It was an underground sample. And but the others, as I pointed out, it mattered a lot when it was a so-called shipping sample, which is a sample, very carefully taken sample, so that it was representative of a whole truckload heading off on the railway line. They'd gone to a lot of trouble to quarter and quarter and quarter and get this representative sample. Well, we'd then take a little bit of that and have to get the closest possible analysis.
Now, you said that the fire assay, this is something I was really interested in, was...
For silver. Silver was a thing. Lead, zinc and silver were the elements that they got paid on. There was always a little bit of gold in with the silver, but not much at this stage, the stage the mine was at. And so the silver analysis, as you said, was due by fire analysis. And here the silver was extracted from the big sample of ore by melting it down with some litharge, and you finished up with a lead button about the size of your fingernail, or the end of your thumb, and that was then taken and put in a furnace at a certain temperature, and the lead was slowly evaporated away. And some of it went into the container, a special container was put in. You finished up with a silver prill, so-called prill, which you would then weigh and get the silver content. But much depended on the temperature of this fire, this furnace, as to whether the silver content would be a little higher or a little lower. And the process, you do lose a little bit with all that lead that went off, but most of it's left behind. And you could adjust just how much you did finish up by adjusting the temperature of the furnace. But it's interesting that the control of the furnace was done by eye. The temperature of the furnace was done by eye. And you think it would be an impossible thing to do, get very accurately by just looking through a peephole at this interior of the furnace. But it was usually, these things were set up in a fairly darkened room, and it so happened that in the course of time, after a few weeks, you could reproduce the same sort of temperatures and same sort of analysis results over quite accurately.
John, you said that there was a fairly active social life there as well, Broken Hill, but I don't know whether it was the temperature or what it was about the hill that led you to apply for the job at ANU.
Yes, well, no, the temperature didn't worry us. My wife didn't worry with the heat. She was very comfortable with it, actually, and it didn't worry me too much. But after 2 years of this very routine life, this is really the thing that made me look around for something else. I'd always hoped for something that had a little more interest in the routine business. I went looking for another position, and one that came up in the newspapers was this requirement in a radiochemistry laboratory in Canberra. I didn't know what radiochemistry was then, so I made application for it.
Now, radiochemistry at the time would have been a relatively new field of study, would that be correct?
Yes, it was really the use of radioactive elements as traces in all sorts of chemical processes. And everyone thought it was... Well, there was a feeling that it was going to be a big thing and take over from lots of other procedures. And actually, it didn't turn out quite that way, because people became more aware of the radioactive nature and not wanting to have it around all over the place.
Yes.
And just keep it for specialised labs where it could be controlled a lot easier. And other things came along, of course, as lots and lots of new works were going on at that time, and it didn't become an absolute necessity to use it, so it was just being put on the side for specialist jobs.
Mm. Actually, I'd forgotten about that, because that material was used in X-rays, and I can remember there was a great interest around that period in doctors being far more careful with their with the radioactivity of X-rays too, not exposing themselves.
Yes, yes. Well, many people had burnt fingers and so on with X-ray equipment. That's slightly different approach to the radioactivity I'm talking about, where it would be atoms of it in solution or in solid situation where you could use it in chemistry,
sure.
Whereas the X-rays coming from a machine. Yes, there was at that stage an expansion of the use of X-rays and the protection for the operators and the patients were just a secondary thought for a while, and that suddenly became very important when it was realised that it wasn't so good for us to be hit upon by X-rays.
So, John, given that you were working in radiochemistry, and that I know that time in Canberra was a time of great expansion, both at the university and in the city, what led you to go from radiochemistry into studying geology? Seems like a most unusual move.
Well, the radiochemistry that was evolving was through a decision to concentrate or make a push on the radioactive dating of rocks and minerals. And radioactive dating of them using the decay schemes of the elements already present in the rocks, like uranium, thorium, potassium decaying to argon, and rubidium decaying to strontium. They got the bright idea that if conditions were right, we could use these decay schemes, which are steady and constant. Over time, the rate of decay is a constant, to make use of this to create a clock or clocks to determine the age of the rocks. And this is where the big push of radiochemistry finished up going.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the only aspect of it that I ever did work on. It was in the dating of rocks, and so I got closer to geology. And the work, but what gave me the impetus to go into this was the beginning of the general studies, the undergraduate teaching at ANU. Where a science faculty, in this expansion, a science faculty was founded, and the teaching of chemistry, physics, geology, botany, zoology commenced. And it seemed sensible to get a bit more geology behind me if I was going to go ahead with the work that I was doing.
Yeah.
And it was encouraged within the university. The new faculties were dying for new students, so the path was, if you wanted to do some more work, the path was there to start. I was in the right place at the right time.
That sounds like it.
Yes.
So, in fact, was it over 4 years you did your degree?
Yes, I to get the degree at ANU, you had to do half of your course in that university. Yeah. Otherwise, they wouldn't give you the degree. So they checked up on my previous work and said, "Oh, that's acceptable."
Yeah.
And so I started off. I decided it was a good idea to do things in runs, and I'd done geology one, so I went through geology two, geology three. There. And then I had a bit of chemistry to clean up, third year physical and inorganic chemistry, and that was hard work. but I got there.
Well, why was it such hard work, John?
Well, I hadn't done chemistry studies for 14 years, chemistry 2 studies, and 14 years before, and of course it had all changed and so on. Yes, it was I had 4 children at that stage. It was family had continued to grow.
Yeah.
And time was at a premium.
So it's pretty helpful that the university actually supported you to.
Oh, yes, it. Yes. They allowed the time off to do it without reduction of salary. And yes, I was very fortunate. Salaries that they knew for, apart from academic staff, were pretty tight. You know, they inherited the British system, I think, where things were pretty tough. Well, it was. The people who came out had been a long time in the British system, and they didn't overpay people, as we all know.
So, John, given that you with your 4 children, you couldn't take honours, as I recall it, because you weren't allowed to do that part-time, but they allowed you to do the master's part-time, which I thought was incredible.
Mm. Yeah, yes, well, that's right. Well, it's the same here. You have to do honours as a full-time course, and you could always do master's as a part-time. You might do it over many years. It was something the university seemed to have kept open so that they wouldn't lose a prospective student. And I think it was a good. It was just the fact that it was done through the master's structure that I was fortunate again for me to run into.
Now, was it during the master's research that you stumbled on something that caused your head of department to view you in favourable eyes?
Yes, I did have a bit of a luck. I had a problem. There was a problem with the work I was doing, and it was just straight chemical analysis, but very, very important for potassium argon dating. And I had the responsibility for doing the potassium analyses. And it turned out that there were interferences from other elements in this sort of work. They were using flame photometric procedures, mm-hmm. and everyone else in the world, of which there were many at the time doing this sort of work, followed those. But it turned out that, cutting a long story short, that the other elements in the materials measured were causing interferences and giving the wrong answers. We finished up with wrong geological ages, but and it made such a difference that it made a nonsense of the geology that came out of it all. And I was fortunate enough to be able to see a way through to neutralise those problems and race ahead and get well ahead of other people at the time. That was soon overcome, though, in this fast-moving world, but I had my hour of sunshine. And as you said, it paid off. It gave me opportunities afterwards.
Yeah. So was it that perhaps that allowed you to apply for a PhD scholarship, do you think?
Mm. Yes, well, I applied under my own belt, but I'm sure it made a big difference. And head of department was a very strong man, and what he said went, and he was pleased with what had been done, and said he did ask me if didn't I think at this time of my life I should get out and enjoy the good life, and I said no, I'd rather prefer to do this now at the moment. He said, all right, if you want to. Another slice of luck.
Mm. And you didn't have to move particularly far.
No, it was interesting that I hadn't. Whilst I was working part-time, I was still in the same seat in the department, and when I became a PhD student, I still stayed in the same seat. And likewise with the next step.
Yeah. Now the next step is really, after this, is something that amazed me, that is it Roy Rutland?
My next step was a year with the Bureau of Mineral Resources.
That's right.
Yeah. As a geochronologist.
Yeah, that's right. I missed that in thinking about that. But in one way, you were checked out by the University of Adelaide, and you got wind of this and written to the head of department there.
I'd heard they were considering doing geochronology and setting up geochronology here. And when I also heard Rutland was coming to Canberra for some meeting, and that I made contact with him, and I can't remember just how, but anyhow, he said he'd be coming over early because he wanted to see some equipment that was in the geology department. And so I told him, well, I'll pick him up from wherever he was and see that he could get there and see it. And a friend of mine who was lecturing in that geology department, and incidentally came from Adelaide, Professor Alan White, as he is now, he arranged on the weekend, on Saturday morning, to open the place up so that Professor Rutland could see what he wanted to see.
Well, that must have been a bit of a help.
Yes. Oh, yes. So he had a look at me too, and the family and so forth. So, of all the applicants who came along later on, I was one that he'd seen.
So, John, you and your family arrive in Adelaide in 1971 after successfully applying for a job that you'd almost had an interview for before you knew you'd had an interview for.
Yeah, that's right.
But can you describe what the Mawson building was like in 1971 when you arrived? What was the feel of the department there?
It was very, very busy. It was a time in the latter part of a mining boom, and the number of geology students at any one time depended on the mining industry. It really did, and when there was a burst in the mining activity, and things did happen with a great rush, it's just the nature of the thing. There was a great interest in the community, and lots of fellas signed up for geology. And I landed right in the middle of one of these when they were up to their ears. And I set about trying to do my business in the middle of all that. I really, looking back, I should have done more to help with the situation.
Were there strong links between the mining industry and the department in Adelaide?
Not as close as there are now. At that point, we're still talking about that point, the staff were absolutely flat out with their teaching and attempting to do research programs. And they were doing some research programs, yes, but the pressure was on the teaching and the marking because of the number of students. And as I was saying, it was at the beginning of the... towards the end of a boom, but this is when the student numbers were at their highest, and then the boom collapsed, and the students had to pass through, let me put it this way, that the numbers that enrolled after were much smaller, but everything was a few years behind the peak of the booms, and in 5 years' time, we'd entered a trough once more, and it was smaller numbers of students.
John, your move to Adelaide also coincided with the probably peak year of the Whitlam government. So was there a fair amount of money floating around the university at that time?
Well, yes and no. I think if you looked either side of it... They were good years. Well, the students had scholarships and things. Yeah. They didn't have undergraduate students didn't have to pay fees, and there were lots of scholarships for postgraduate students, higher degree students. In that sense, there was a lot of money. There were still battles between the departments within the faculties to try and get more money and improve their departments and get. And the pressure was on to enter the new world and get research equipment, lots of research equipment, which is something they would have never got out of Mr. Edgelow. and so on. And Commonwealth money had come in. But I find it a little difficult to weigh up the degree of that. because I wasn't there in the few years before. And but it seemed to me that on what the other staff members told me, that they had practically nothing in those years before when the Whitlam money started to fly around.
Can you compare it in any way with ANU, John, with the student response to that era? Because as I understand it, it was a time when students were pushing for departmental democracy, and there was a fair bit of activity, I suppose you'd call it in a nice way, going on.
Yes, there was an awful lot of activity. The students seemed to, the higher degree students, of which there were a lot at the time, there were a lot. They were a sizable proportion of the population. Within the university, within the geology department, they had their own little group. They called it AUGS, Adelaide University Geological Society, their own, and they used to run cricket matches and meetings and Friday afternoon grogs. they were very active, and in Rutland's time, he let them run the whole thing, which meant we didn't have to. But some of them were pretty wild, but there's no doubt about it. They'd get up to all sorts of pranks.
And you had to teach these students.
Yeah, well, yes. I'd supervise them when they'd got to the higher degree stage.
So was your initial task more fitting out the laboratory and getting all that done?
Well, there hadn't been any geochronology work or trace element work done there before. And for geochronology, you had to have a clean laboratory and chemical laboratory where we could do the chemical separations of the things involved, and that had to be planned and set up. And also another machine was required, a machine called a mass spectrometer, which was a key to isotopic studies, which were necessary for geological dating. And I had to seek out and purchase one of those, and the money available made it rather difficult. But still, we managed to get one that could do, after a few modifications, would do the job for the next 10 years quite happily. Mm. But it took a bit of work to get it up to scratch.
Gosh, I bet it did. Now, can you talk a little bit about some of the other people that you were teaching there with at the time? What was Professor Rutland like as a person and to work with, John?
Well, he had a big job, but he was very quick in understanding, and which was his asset. And he was a great debater, and he could always he had a way with him. He could get someone into a room that he disagreed with and wanted to come to some decision over an item. And he could get this guy in there and agreeing with everything that this chap wanted, but send him out of the room agreeing to do what he wanted. So it was... I heard later on when he went to the Bureau of Mineral Resources that a lot of people just couldn't work out what had happened to them because he had this technique which would be very, very friendly unless the person was doing something that was outrageous. He was very friendly, had a lot of energy to do this.
Goodness, but a great persuader.
A great persuader. Oh, yes, indeed.
So who were some of the others in the department, and what were their research interests? Can you remember?
In the department, yes. John Jones, soon after I got there, Rutland introduced a deputy head, and John Jones was the chap he took for that. He was 2 years younger than me, actually. He was a mineragrapher. And one of his interests was opal. He did a lot of work on opal, and he also used X-ray work for his mineralogy, he did a lot of the early work on trying to work out why asbestos was so dangerous. And was the first to push that it must be the micro size of the crystals whereby it slipped in the pores of the skin and stuck there. Yes, and Alfred Kleeman had been there, one of Mawson's staff, had been there for a long time. He unfortunately had oncoming Parkinson's disease, and I couldn't understand why his condition, and because I'd heard of him as being a highly active gentleman, but he'd slowed down so fast, I wondered what it was, and then it came out it was Parkinson's disease. But he was a very, very fastidious and reader. He I don't know anyone who kept up with a range of literature like he did, and he didn't do much research, but his students got the latest off the world platform, and they got on, a lot of his students got on very well in the world.
That was at a time when it wasn't so easy to access that material either.
Yes, although the Bar Smith Library had a big push about that time, and they
probably Poseidon money, John.
I don't know whether the library did get much of that. The Mineral Foundation got a $2 million building out at Glenside, which is worth an awful lot more than that now. Eric Rudd, the just retired professor for economic geology, he was still round the place, but he'd just retired. Professor Glazner was there, the paleontologist, who came from Europe, one of those that had to leave in wartime, pre-wartime days, and he was a big asset to the department. For the breadth of his reading, also. Unusual man, he was. I'm talking about Glazner.
Eric Rudd was previous. Was Glazner a professor?
Yes. He also had a doctorate in law.
Now that's what I remember about him. Yes, he did.
A doctorate in law, which and when he retired, he had to retire at retiring age, the way it was at that point, and he. And the superannuation, the uni superannuation at that stage was in a very shocking stage, and he just went away and asked if he could be any help in the legal area. When they found out his qualifications, he immediately finished up sitting in on court cases. So, well, there you are. It's nice to have another string to your bow, but what a string.
So it's a pretty active department you came into, John.
Yes, Brian Daly, a great field man.
Yes, he was.
Brian Daly and, let me see, Brian McGarren, another paleontologist. He actually went away to the Mines Department for replaced Glazner when he left. No, Bob Nesbitt was a very young geochemist Arthur Alderman took on at the beginning of when Alderman began. Took him on straight from his PhD. Apparently he had a brilliant career as undergraduate and so on, Bob Nesbitt. Ross Botha just replaced Eric Rudd. Not Eric Rudd, replaced the other chap was in economic geology. What was his name? He went away to I can't remember his name. Eric Whittle. Not Eric Whittle, Whittle anyhow. And so Ross Botha was new in economic geology. There are others there too. I could look in my book and.
That's wonderful, thank you, John. That gives a very clear picture of what was really quite a large department at that point.
Yes, it grew to 18 in the time I was there. There were more than what I mentioned, but I don't know why.
Now, one thing I'm interested in, John, was there still, if you like, a Mawson tradition around the place? Were there still stories hanging around, or was he still revered? How did people talk about him in those times?
Well, he had gone, but there was Mawson stories all over the place. I'd started hearing Mawson stories when I was in Canberra.
Had you?
Yeah, because the petrologist who was teaching in the general studies, where I did my geology, was Alan White, who was one of Mawson's students. Mawson's last honour student, I think, he claims to be. And he was full of stories. He had them all. And we've put a few of them in that book that I told you about. Yes. There's a chapter on such things.
The anecdotal side of the department.
Anecdotal, that's right.
Yeah. I can remember even as an undergraduate that in arts that we had all sorts of strange stories coming out of the geology department.
Ah, well, yes. Yeah, and that was well after he'd left, wasn't it?
Long after he died.
After he died, yeah.
So that's nearly 20 years after he left.
Yes, the stories still go on. I'm glad we put as many as we could into the book, because things were beginning to fade, and Stuart was right. It was time to get all this stuff down.
Yes, now, that Robin Oliver. We'll come to that later too, about how all this came about. But what I was getting at was, were you aware of that tradition in the department, if you like?
Yes. I knew that before I came to the department from Canberra. Mm. It became clear that, because there was just Mawson, Madigan, and one or two others at the time, and relieving people.
Yes.
And that was it. And everything that happened... Mawson used to take them on field trips. Mm. The way he worked field trips was he had a big car himself, a Dodge or something, and he wanted to do field work, say, in the Flinders Ranges. And he'd take the third year's field excursion would be this trip up there, and he'd get them to map some of the area that he was working his project on. He'd get manpower, and they would learn the mapping procedures in the process. He also had some sort of interest in the forests at Kaipo down here.
That was a personal interest he had down there.
Yeah, but he took students down there and the mapping classes, and give them a chunk of land to survey. They did surveying in those days too, which has dropped out completely. And they do their surveying work there. And if there weren't any rocks to see, that was too bad for that one. They do their surveying anyhow, but in the Flinders they did both.
Yeah. I've seen some very early photographs in the 1920s, I think it was, or 30s, of students with Mawson in the Flinders. So he was obviously into that right from the beginning of his career.
Yes, he. When he came here, apparently, let's put it this way, geologists in those days did mainly field work, and what they do, they start pick on an area which they thought would be interesting, and then they start the field work, which take time to work over, and they'd build up their story of the geology in their patch. And that became their patch. And when Mawson came here, he found that the patches here were pretty well taken up. So he first went to an area west of Broken Hill.
Yeah, that's right.
And used Broken Hill as the base. And that's where he met his wife, mine manager's daughter.
Exactly.
And so he got out back and in what we call the O'Leary block now. He did a lot of work there. And then he moved over to the Flinders afterwards, the northern Flinders, not just the southern Flinders.
Now John, Mawson himself was a student of Edgeworth David in Sydney, I think, wasn't he?
Mm-hmm.
And In Adelaide, there was, in the early 20th century, there was the indomitable Walter Houchin. Was that sense of history still part of the department's makeup when you joined it? I mean, did they know about those people, or was it really at that stage pretty much forgotten?
Well, Houchin wrote a book which was the standard for South Australia for quite a long time.
Well, that helps.
yes. Well, this was starting to slip aside now, but Houchin fitted in very well. He wanted to do as much, as far as I can see, he wanted to do as much geology as he could. But he was a church minister, and that was it. That was his major job. But they didn't. On top of that, he was president of the Royal Society.
He was
of South Australia for
over three decades. I'm pretty sure that I'm right on that.
Yeah. Well, that was his spare time work. But when Morton wanted to go away a lot, Houchin just fitted in. Really. And he didn't think twice about Mawson going to World War I. And he actually joined the British Army. And I'm told he did that. He didn't join the Australian Army because he got a salary in the British Army. And a pension. Of a scale that he couldn't get here.
Well, there's also a rumour that he was actually actively involved in intelligence.
Well, he might have been too, yes.
Which might have made the salary even more attractive.
Yeah, well, I don't know everything. And you know bits here and there.
I'll just create a new session on the recording.